This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodi. Today's children and young people will be the lost generation of this COVID-19 pandemic. Not only have they lost at least a year of education, it's also been a year of lost opportunities and friendships. There has been a lot of talk about access to online learning, but what about access to mental health support for both students and teachers? So on the show today, we have Dr. Arman Rashid. He's the Director of Research and Advocacy at Souls Health, and joining us also Lim Jing Yi. She's from Teach from Malaysia. Welcome, both of you. How are you today?
Thank you, Meera. Thanks for having us on the show.
You're most welcome. Jing Yi, you were for 2 years in a secondary school in Pasir Gudang, Johor. You actually taught as part of the Teach for Malaysia fellowship program. You want to just share that that experience with us? I mean, you taught a fair bit during the pandemic as well.
Yeah, so in my 2 years, I started in 2019. In the first year itself, being in a school that is primarily consisting of members of underprivileged communities meant that I really saw a side of their lives and how mental health is a part of the challenges that they face in their daily life. And when the pandemic hit and the school closures happened in 2020, we had to immediately go online, and it was something that was unprecedented. There was a lot of adapting to do, and it wasn't easy. But as we can see now, schools have also closed and opened multiple times. And we're still all learning how to adapt.
Okay. And in terms of, you know, they already have stresses as the underprivileged communities. How did COVID sort of come and, you know, it probably would have made things a lot worse, didn't it?
Yeah. So being in Pasir Gudang, in 2019, I'm sure you've heard about the toxic pollution in Kim Kim River. So that was one of the first things that I experienced as a teacher there. That was one of the bigger stressors in the year, and you could see how it affected the students. There were a lot of cases of heightened anxiety and stress. And typically in that area, most parents either work in Singapore or work in the factories surrounding the area because it is an industrial area. And during the pandemic, this meant that a lot of parents that worked in Singapore were not able to come home. So I had students who up until now may not have seen their parents for about a year. And there are other parents who work in the surrounding factories who are struggling financially. Yeah, so it's a difficult place to be growing up. And on top of like not being able to go to school, see their friends, have that sense of normalcy, I can say that the kids have learned to adapt however they can, but it's still difficult for me to see that.
Yeah. How did you cope mentally as a teacher?
It wasn't easy. Like it was a shared struggle for many, many teachers that I knew. We had to learn and adapt how to teach online, and we had to also kind of learn to work within our locus of control, right? So there were a lot of things happening, and maybe we were far away from our students, maybe we couldn't check in on them physically, and we kind of just had to come up with new strategies time and time again, right? Whether that's by engaging the students with like new methods of learning, or just calling in and checking up on your students, or coming up with more initiatives that deal with the mental health of the students directly.
Okay. Arman, you were going to say something?
Yeah, thanks, Jing Yi, for sharing that. Look, I mean, from what we hear and what we see around, right, COVID-19 has seriously impacted on the education system and how we learn and how do we teach. And this has put a lot of pressure on not only students, but also teachers and transitioning online. This may have been inevitable and unavoidable, and maybe even the future of education, but it does come with several constraints: access to technology, sense of isolation, detachment, the high level of stress that is being experienced, for example, in evaluation from both sides, from the teachers and students as well. So there are mental health stresses that we really can't ignore at this point. And given the children have remained largely at home, restless, some cases demotivated, and the long-term implications for how they're learning and the mental health implications of that.
I mean, you were teaching Form 1s to Form 3 children, right? Yeah. I mean, that's like the age where, you know, it's teenage years, it's puberty, it's everything coming to be. And without parental guidance or support at home, that must have been quite a challenge.
I would say that for my students, many of them tell me that they're quite used to it. So maybe they've lived a life where they feel like that support is not a given. So when this the situation kind of escalated for them, it kind of felt just a little bit different. It wasn't like a drastic change. And they kind of found new ways to cope. So that kind of translated into them maybe not showing up for classes, attendances would be low, they were not motivated for some of the students. And for some of the students who typically would be already very motivated to learn, the stress levels got even higher because they could not learn the same way in school as they did in school. And it became a point of what am I learning? What am I doing? And, you know, maybe next year I'm supposed to have my SPM, I'm supposed to have my PT3, and I feel like I haven't learned anything the entire year. Yeah. I have some students who actually just stopped coming to classes and took up a part-time job. Yeah. It's whatever gets them through the day.
Yeah. And there's nothing you can do about it, right? Do you have to report it to the Ministry of Education when that happens?
No. So typically what I do is just try to check in with them more. And if it's a case of them not showing up for class, yes, we do fill out reports about all these things, but it is not up to us to tell the kid that, oh, yes, we do tell them, yes, you must come to class. But the decision kind of isn't in our hands. And that's where a lot of the pressure comes from for teachers as well. It's wanting the children to succeed, wanting them to show up, wanting them to learn, wanting for them to learn, but then not being able to have control over like many, many different factors that affect their lives.
Aman, Souls Health is a community-based mental health center. Did you see an influx of people coming forward for help from the center over the last one
definitely.
Year, perhaps?
Yeah? We've seen a spike in the number of clients, the client requests that we get, particularly after the pandemic. And when, you know, we were one center that actually transitioned online immediately. We were not actually disrupted by even a day. So we saw a spike in the number of clients, both online and then when we opened partially during the CMCO, the same thing. We do see more clients coming to us. And some clients would come with, of course, presenting issues directly related to COVID-19, where, you know, I mean, whether it's deal with the financial upheavals, the emotional problems that they're going through. But also sometimes they'll come with other presenting issues, but you would see that how many of those issues have been aggravated further by the pandemic. So someone who is feeling lonely feels even more lonely and isolated in this situation. Someone feels who has been feeling demotivated feels even more lack of motivation at this point. So we definitely see how, in terms of numbers, but also the cases we are getting, the COVID-19 has affected the mental health of our clients and across age groups. So this is something that we see not only confined to any particular age group or particular demographic group, but across the board.
So let's focus on the children and the teens today, because we want to find out their mental health issues and what surfaced over the last one year, especially in relation to education. So if you have a question for us, 7733 2900 is the number to call. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, the 2019 National Health and Morbidity Survey found that almost 500,000 children and teens experience mental health issues. And this not necessarily are diagnosed disorders, but any sort of mental stress or strain. That is already alarming. This is a 2019 report. I cannot imagine what that would look like today. What are your thoughts on that, Arman?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at 2019 National Health and Morbidity Survey, there were over 424,000 children suffering from mental health. And so what COVID-19 has done in a way is aggravated an existing crisis that we had. So there's something that we need to bear in mind, that the mental health crisis we see affecting children in Malaysia now is not new or unique to the pandemic, but the pandemic has made it even more difficult. The same study mentioned, right, the National Health Morbidity Study, also shows that 1 in 10 aged between 10 and 15 years old has some sort of a mental health stress that they're going through. And suicide risks, which go and affect students as early as Form 1. But what's important to bear in mind here is that this reflects the overall stress and anxiety and not necessarily mental health conditions. However, there are long-term risks, and some of these childhood adversities that they're going through or traumatic experiences may have long-term impacts, including intergenerational effects, right, that we can see. So it's really important for us to try to break the cycle. And to break that cycle, we need to really address the mental health. And bearing in mind that, some of that it's not, in for most people, it's really not the case of mental health disorders. How can we have early interventions, right, which can look at mental health not only from a reactive way, but also a preventive way? So this is where, the challenge now is that, bearing in mind the scale of the crisis, taking into account the limited number of mental health professionals and resources that we have, how do we make mental health more accessible and affordable? And to do that, we have to break the stigma and also ensure access from not only formal mental health services, but also informal services from the community. Yeah. And that's where it's really important for all stakeholders and a whole of society approach, right, to play a role in the mental health of children and students.
Informal services in the community. We'll come back to that. I mean, I think, honestly, let's just be honest. That is really the solution. We cannot have enough mental health professionals. That's next to impossible. But question is, how do we have an informal mental health service in the community? How what does it even look like? If you have an idea, we'll talk about that after this. Jingyi, in terms of besides the, the stresses of education, how does the stresses of being in lower income communities sort of make it worse for these children?
I think one primary way is actually through the access to opportunities. So there's actually quite limited number of opportunities available to these communities. And it's part of them not being able to see what is out there in the world for them, or not having the economic access to these things. On top of that, I think a lot of times when we talk about low-income communities, it's how their parents are also maybe involved or not involved in their lives. I have many students who might live in overcrowded houses and do not have very positive relationships with their parents and with their siblings. And this kind of shapes their worldview as well. They kind of only want to grow up, get a job, move on to another new stage of their life, but they're not having that freedom and that privilege to plan what and think about what it is they want with their lives.
Yeah. Okay. We'll come back and continue the discussion. If you have a question on children and teens experiencing mental health issues, I think over the last 1 year or so in relation to education, they are, as we call them, the lost generation of this COVID-19 pandemic. I mean, they've only been to school last year, like 4 months or something, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, about.
So many don't even have gadgets to be a part of this education process. And you know what? They're sitting for SPM on the 22nd of February. In all of this, they have to sit for exams. What does that actually mean? So we'll come back and find out. If you have a question for any one of our guests, or if you want to contribute an experience or share an experience, number to call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 0187898899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. It's our Health and Living segment. We're discussing COVID-19 and, you know, how children and teachers are coping with the stresses of COVID-19. Dr. Arman Rashid, Director of Research and Advocacy at Souls Health, as well as Lim Jing Yi from Teach for Malaysia, joining us to share their thoughts. Jing Yi has taught for 2 years as part of the Teach for Malaysia Fellowship at a secondary school in Pasir Gudang, Johor. It's interesting that it was near that area where there was a pollution issue. I think it was 2 years ago, wasn't it? About that time, it started then, and you know, moving on now to the pandemic, and you know how things have been thrown off for them. You know, Jing Yi, exams are going to be held. SPM going to be held on 22nd of February. I don't know what kind of impact do you see this having on the students. I mean, you've got extremes, right? Children who are overachievers and really want to do well and have been hard on themselves, as you said, and if they've only been to schools for such a short time last year, what does that mean for them? You also have those who have been, you know, deprived or neglected because education has not been accessible to them. So what kind of exam do you think this is going to be at the end of the day? What is it going to achieve?
I'm not sure. I think it's just done as a way to kind of let them go through the system to get on to the next stage of their life at this point, I think. I think that, so I primarily teach Form 1 to Form 3, but when schools first reopened after the first MCO, they had to reshuffle some of the teachers. So I had the opportunity to teach some of the Form 5 students. So from my conversations with them, what I understood was they kind of felt afloat. Even the students who maybe typically aren't very high achievers, they know what they want from this exam because it is actually a huge milestone in all of our lives as Malaysians, right? Who went to public school. So for them, they had an idea of what they wanted to do and they were building up to it, but then their momentum just kept getting, you know, cut off. And this year, even the plan to reopen schools has been changed again and again. Currently, they are still learning from home. I heard from a colleague back in school that they are allowed to have extra classes, class tambahan, but it's like a day, 2 hours. And that kind of lack of structure is very difficult for them to find the kind of motivation that they need to go into the exams feeling confident and feeling like this was how they kind of envisioned it would be, because it has been building up for many years for these students.
Okay. Arman, when children become anxious, I cannot imagine that the SPM holders, I mean, those sitting for exams, for an example, or if they're feeling depressed, how do they even recognize that?
Well, thanks, Mira, for the question. And, you know, to build on what he said, for students, in class, the anxiety and uncertainty for almost a year now. So it's been bad enough. And now we have SPM and SPM exams. And like you said, we all know it's almost like a rite of passage. It impacts on your future study and career goals. So it definitely impacts on them. And there are definitely many signs that we can look out for, right? So, and some of them would be, you know, feeling burnt out. I think the fact is a lot of students are feeling exhausted now. We do know that online learning depletes your energy even more, physically and emotionally. And then on top of this, these students have been repeatedly going through past year papers again and again. And with the uncertainty, when would the exams really take place? So it's really a huge problem. And then there are signs that we can look out for, like I said, right? Lack of concentration. If you're feeling that it's difficult to focus, you're feeling very tired. A lot of that really is a signs of a burnout that you're possibly having. Other than that, you know, some of the signs that we can look out for are physical symptoms like headaches, eye strains, feeling that you're, you know, demotivated. These all could be signs that we could look out for, right? In terms of students who are going through oppression now. And, you know, as we said, right, as it is, SPM exams cause a lot of, you know, pressure, and now even more so during this pandemic that we are going through.
You know, they say that skipping classes, not keeping up with studies is an indication that students are not coping well. But I would feel like it's widespread now. And it is, what sort of a problem has it become? Is it a mental health problem? Is it just that you're demotivated? Or how do you even make that differentiation?
Look, I think it's a combination of all of that, right? So, I mean, like you said, right, if you're not showing up for classes, if you're not submitting your assessments, that's a clear sign that something is wrong. There's no doubt about it. Having said that, some of these problems have existed even before the pandemic. So it's really, I mean, the challenge here is really for teachers to assess it. And now it's difficult because, okay, I mean, let's face it. I mean, just like any video conferencing call, you're actually seeing your students through, you know, small boxes, right? So it's really hard to really assess the emotional state of how students are doing by teachers, right? Even if they can, you know, look at, you know, like, okay, missed homeworks, missed deadlines, but really it's really hard to see beyond that. So I think that's something that we have to bear in mind, right? So, and the question is, right, that some degree of stress, right, might be a normal, right? I mean, it's actually quite inevitable in this crisis that we're going through. It's okay not to feel okay. And some stress may also be helpful, right? Like, we know that, you know, good stress and bad stress.
Yeah.
But the question is, when does good stress become bad stress? And when it becomes bad stress, that's when we have a long-term risk of mental health conditions. What could be symptoms of anxiety and depression could actually become a full-blown mental health disorder that could affect them in the future. So it's really important for us, right? If teachers are constrained because of online learning, in that case, parents and family members, right, the caregivers too, we look out for the warning signs, the early signs, right, for interventions to take place as soon as possible to prevent it from escalating.
But as Jingyi said, in some cases, there is no support. There's no guidance. There's absolutely nothing. So how do we build their resilience? Is it ever too late to build the resilience, Amir?
Look, it's never late to build resilience. It's never built to resilience. And I think this is where we need a really whole of society approach where, parents are not there, the caregivers, whoever is there has to play a supportive role. It's difficult because sometimes the conversation on online learning has really focused a lot on really the teaching material. Yes, like grandparents, for example, who don't really know how Zoom works, for example. So that's one part of the story. But the other part of the story is really the emotional support that children need during this time. Bear in mind, children have to deal with mental health stressors that they go through along with those of their parents or their family members. So it's really important for whether it's parents are not there, caregivers are there, to really engage with the students, engage with them, connect with them for emotional check-ins to see how are you doing, how are you feeling, and then trying to understand what their needs are and work around that and tell them it's okay not to feel okay. It's okay to seek help. And that seek help does not need to be only professional mental health services. We know there's a limited access for that. But even seeking out emotional support from your family, peers, friends. I understand a lot of that is really difficult because the online platforms you use, even access to, for example, teachers or school counselors. And that's where those who are staying with the children, right, at home, really have a higher responsibility, whoever the caregivers are, whether they're parents or someone else.
Sorry.
Yeah, so very important point that Dr. Aman brought up is that we need to check in on the emotional well-being of the students. And this is something that me and many of my friends who are also in the fellowship have talked about a lot, especially when the pandemic happened. Like, as much as we are feeling the stresses as adults, the students, the children are as well. So there are points where we make it, there has to be a trade-off. Is it their academics that are more important, or is it their emotional well-being that is more important? And I am lucky enough that most of my students weren't in exam years. So for me, it was an easy choice to make. Like, I had to prioritize their well-being. So it became, we actually came together to really think about what is it we can do to check in on the students' well-being. It can be as easy as before a lesson, ask the students how they're doing, throw in like an emotional wheel, ask them to identify what it is they're feeling, to build that awareness. But it also just opens up that access for them to talk about their feelings and whatever they're facing. I have other friends who also started initiatives that surround building emotional resilience in the students. So being able to do things like psychoeducation, teaching them about feelings and what do you do about your feelings and kind of the choices that they can make. Like Dr. Arman said, asking for help when you need it. These are all things that a lot of people around these students, around these children can do. And it's something that I feel like we have to prioritize. Yeah.
So given your situation in Pasir Gudang, would you say the teachers were sort of a very, very important role for these children in terms of mental health support, do you think? Because they don't have access to, I'm not sure if they have counsellors in schools. I don't think there are NGOs nearby who would give them that sort of support. So would you say then the teachers are the ones who are very, very important in this?
Yes, I would say so. There are still school counselors that are available. In particular, like my previous school, the school counselors actually put all the students who had previous maybe cases or saw the counselors regularly into a Telegram group to make sure that that channel of communication is open. Mm-hmm. There have been multiple like attempts to reach out to students just to let them know, okay, someone is here if you need to talk. But outside of that, teachers are the people who already have an existing relationship with these students. We have the most access in a sense because counselors, while they are there and they are professionals, students may not know them personally. They may not feel that trust that needs to be established for them to just come out and say, this is what I'm facing. So teachers having that trust and relationship is kind of a point of connection. So for me, when I have students who are struggling with something, I have to be the one to play the part where I listen to them, and I have to, if they need more help, refer them to someone else who can help them better.
Would you know of schools who have coped very well in terms of providing the support both for students and teachers by any chance? No, everybody just neglects the teachers, I suppose, number one. And then we hope the teachers will support the kids. Is that what's going on?
I think that I know of the fact that for all school district offices, there is a counselor there for the teachers to go and see. But I'm not sure about how much the teachers actually use this opportunity. Overall, I feel like the main mental health support for teachers is actually community. So that's something that me and my other friends from the fellowship have also tried to work on. We've started an online platform for like resource sharing, just to make sure people have practical means of like solving issues that face, whether that's online learning or student well-being, or even just going back to yourself as a teacher and your own well-being.
Okay. And in terms of community help in the mental health services in the community, you just mentioned a few of some of your friends who have set up something on their own to help like that. It's very informal, right? But Dr. Arman, how much more can we do like this?
We do know. I mean, in a way, right, this crisis can also be an opportunity for us. And that's where to really rethink how we engage with teachers, we engage with students. And I think there's a growing recognition now on how the mental health of teachers are interrelated with the mental health of students. So we've seen NGOs and community groups working with schools in developing mental health literacy of teachers. We've seen teachers working with parents and particularly recognizing that the online learning needs the support and involvement of parents. So there are initiatives taking place at the local level, at the community level. The question is, how do we scale this up? Speaking about teachers specifically, the Ministry of Education, for example, has now a psychology and counseling division, which is offering support to public school teachers. They have launched a program called the 3A Project, Aware, Alert and Action, on raising the psychological well-being of teachers. So there's definitely awareness about it. So it's the issue of right, really how to expand that. And that's where we need to really move. At Source Health, we believe, right, that in this concept of task sharing in the mental health field, which essentially means that we can't rely only on the mental health professionals for improving the mental health at the community level, simply because of the numbers that we talk about. Jingyi also mentioned this just now. The fact is we just don't have enough counselors. And so in the task sharing model, we need to empower other stakeholders, including teachers, to really have not only awareness, but go beyond awareness to identifying, detecting, and also referring if needed. And that sort of informal triage process is really important, because not everybody needs specialized mental health support. A lot of people, a lot of children can really cope with the emotional support that they get from their community resources, from their families, caregivers, and from their teachers.
Jenny, did you want to add on?
Yeah. So there are many resources that are already available in the way that Dr. Arman said. It could be just families, just teachers. Sometimes there are NGOs as well. In terms of being able to support the students inside this pandemic, one of the things that we've done is actually to kind of just also test the students for their anxiety levels and stress levels to see how they are doing and to provide intervention where there's needed. For example, in my previous school, we did actually collaborate with an NGO that's based in Johor, and we found that in the 120 students that we tested, there were like 30% of students who had like moderate to high levels of anxiety. And then being able to provide, not specifically like counseling, but being able to provide like psychoeducation to give them the skills that they need to cope. Yeah, so that whenever something that is as big as this pandemic happens, they have the skills in the future.
And also, Jingyi, to add to what you said, the same trend of high levels of stress, anxiety, and depressive symptoms are also visible in teachers, particularly in public schools. So really, in a way, we have to look at it in a very cohesive way, that how the mental health of teachers and students are interrelated. And in a way, equipping teachers, right, with the mental health knowledge, skills, tools will help not only their mental health, but also the mental health of the students they're engaging with. And the bottom line here to me, right, whether it's community in the form of teachers or whether it's parents, family members, it's really to give the emotional safe space for children that's so important. We often, as a society, look at the physical and material needs of children, whether they're adolescents or teenagers, which is, of course, important. We look at education, what they're learning, because that is the rite of passage, as you said, right? If you do well in the SPMs, you do well in life. But there's also the emotional needs that children have that need to be recognized and acknowledged, and more so during this pandemic than ever before. And that's where I feel that no matter what challenges we are facing, this can be really a push that we needed as a society to see how we can connect with children better and addressing their emotional needs along with other needs that they have.
So if I were to say, Arman, that I want to now start supporting children in their mental health, how would I go about doing it?
Okay, first of all, charity begins at home. Mm-hmm. Creating a supportive environment for emotional expression and help seeking at home, listening and acknowledging feelings, go to your child and speak to your child, of course, about how was their, what did they learn that day, but also how are they feeling. And that safe emotional space where they can express themselves, there's no alternative to that. And of course, if you see that there are some signs of stresses, you try to help. And if you can't help, and if you feel that the risks are high, you connect to a mental health professional. But that's at a later stage, but really begins with family members, parents, caregivers. It's not really quantity of time, because I do understand that parents are also juggling with their own work and family commitments, and often they're also constrained. So, but at the same time, it's not really quantity, but the quality of time you spend with them. I also want to add in here something that, what I mentioned earlier, that the mental health stressors of children are that of their own and also of their parents. So it's also important for the parents and family members to have their own emotional check-in at the same time as with the children.
Who's going to check in on the parents now?
Well, some degree of self-check-in as well, but that's why I think, absolutely, but it's a good question though. Who's going to check in on the parents? It's all interrelated there. And it's important, that's why it's really important for us to really have these tools more accessible. And the good thing is with the last year, despite all the upheavals that we've gone through with the pandemic, there is a growing awareness of mental health in Malaysia, more than ever before. Everyone's talking about mental health. The government, there's almost a bipartisan consensus on this issue between both sides of the political divide. The community groups are talking about it. So almost every sector is keen because, in a way, the next big pandemic a lot of people fear is really the mental health. Yeah. Consequences of COVID-19.
Yeah. So if there are five questions parents should ask them or sort of check in on themselves and, ask themselves, what would it be?
Okay, it starts with checking in with themselves, I suppose, because before they engage in the conversation there, how are you feeling yourself? And then the second question would be that, what are your concerns and at this point and how would you actually handle them? And then you connect to your children and ask yourself, have you really been engaging with your children? Have you been asking them the questions that you need to ask them beyond just, the academic and, the physical needs that they have? To how are you feeling? How are you coping with this? What could I do? What could I do to help you? Or what could you do to help yourself? Who else could you seek out help from? Who could you talk to about this? So these are all those questions that, the basic questions that parents can ask themselves and extend it to children as well.
Okay. So maybe just being a good friend at this point will be support, right?
Absolutely.
I don't have to set up an NGO. I don't have to do anything formal. Just be there and listen, perhaps. Would you say that's a good start for everyone?
Absolutely. Being present, being there, and also acknowledging, right, that it's not been an easy time. Some compassion for yourself, for parents, and also compassion for those around you, and most importantly, your children is so important. This has not been the best year for any of us last year. So to expect the same level of academic results, the same level of diligence from your children is just not realistic. And bearing in mind that, the school disruption, Mira, schools are not only for, of course, the academic learning is the most important, but it's not the only thing. Schools play such an important social support system for the emotional social development. And that has been disrupted even more than the learning. The learning, to some extent, has been mitigated by Zoom and online classes, Google classes. So parents really have to fill that gap more than anything else at this point. And it starts by being a good friend and in a very non-judgmental safe space that you can provide to your children to feel free to express themselves and talk about what they're going through.
Okay. Jingyi, I always get this question when the kids were younger. So how was school? Oh, it was okay. And that's it. Then after that, I'm like, okay, how do I go on with this conversation? How do you manage that, Jingyi, with the children?
I guess since I see them in school, I would probably ask them how are things at home. So typically the answer would be the same. It was okay. I tend to try to listen in more on their conversations with each other, actually. So I'll pick up on the things they say to each other. Maybe they will say things like, for example, I haven't seen my dad since MCO started, for example. Maybe they're saying that to a friend. And it's not like they're whispering it to each other. So I was just passing by. Maybe I would latch onto that. And then in a later conversation, I would ask, how are you doing? Have you talked to your parents lately? Are they still working in Singapore? How are they doing over there? So things like that. So just trying to tease out more details. And I also always trust that once you slowly build that relationship, they will come to you if they feel like they want to share. Mm-hmm. And being able to respect that as well for them. They are still children, technically, 13 to 15. But they do... I do prioritize giving them that sense of agency, teaching them why it's important to share, but also they have that choice where who they share it with. Yeah.
Would you have an experience you want to share that you really had to deal with when it came to mental health?
So I have quite a few students who are in quite a... At least when I was still in school, they were going through quite a crisis, I would say, because of maybe family issues that they were facing. So maybe they have parents who are not supportive, that are definitely going through a hard time, and they can't find the safe space in order to kind of just exist even within their own family. They feel kind of like they are not belonging in their family unit. And so they bring that stress to school, and sometimes you would see them not participating in class or acting out in class, depending on the kid. They all have different coping mechanisms. So when that happens, just being able to pull them out of class after class has ended and talking to them about it has been kind of my approach to it. Sometimes it doesn't end there. Sometimes it's an issue that I can't solve, right? So being able to have those sustained conversations with them, just to continuously check in on them and to make them understand that there is someone on their side and, you know, they can talk to somebody about it.
Push comes to shove, there's no support, then, you know, suicide is of concern, Dr. Arman. How do we manage that?
Mira, the suicide is definitely a concern. I mean, this does not mean that every student or child who's going through a mental health stressors will go through a suicide risk, but suicide risk cannot be ruled out as well. And this is where, again, I go back to teachers and parents looking at the early signs, really. You have to start with the early signs. And we talk about some of the symptoms, difficulties in concentration, not submitting your homework, feeling tired, fatigued, social withdrawal, when you see that they're withdrawing from social interactions, engagements, sleeping problems, changes in appetite. So looking out for all these signs, right? High level irritability, for example. So, and that's when you can see, right, that early interventions can take place. But the fact is quite often, right, the self-harm risks remain there. And we have seen, right, that National Health and Morbidity Study has shown that students as early as Form 1, for example, are going through risk of suicide ideation and also suicide attempts. So this way, again, we need to really make sure that formal and informal community level support is accessible. And really, when it comes to those who are, you know, like if you as a parent, you're seeing those early signs are escalating to possible deterioration, you have to reach out for specialized counseling support, which are focused on children. And that's where we need to look at creative, expressive forms of therapy, bearing in mind, right, that, you know, for counselors, but also for teachers and parents, when you're engaging with children and talking about mental health, it really cannot be a conversation about, as we have with adults, where, oh, how are you feeling and all, because children have different ways of expressing themselves. So, so that's where I feel that we need to really empower students to reach out for help if they need to get that help. And there's definitely a risk of the physical and emotional stress they're going through of escalating further. And that's something that we cannot rule out at all.
Okay. Jingyi, would you have a message for us in mental health when it comes to teachers and students?
I think it goes back to the fact that mental health for teachers and students have always been, it's not a new thing. We have been struggling for a long time, but it's only been exacerbated because of the pandemic, like we've mentioned earlier. What we can do about it is to really invest in community care. So instead of just saying, like, you should take care of yourself and to emphasize on self-care, there is that necessity to organize and to make sure that people have the resources that they need in order to care for not only themselves, but each other. And this is important because we need to give these students, particularly these children, the skills in order to cope for any kind of challenge that might come in the future in their lives. Yeah.
Okay. And who do you think should lead that? Who do you think should lead that, Jingyi?
I think it's... Currently, I feel like there is something to be done by teachers in terms of, like, within the community, because we are the ones, as I mentioned earlier, who have an access to the students in a way that a lot of other stakeholders do not, which is why I feel like being able to be part of the fellowship was a big, big part of my journey in mental health. In my first year of the fellowship, that's when I realized I wanted to go into mental health and become a mental health professional. And having that structural support, like not only with Just Teach for Malaysia as a fellow, but with the schools that you're working directly with, other teachers, and being able to also try to build relationships with the community that you're working in. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. What Jingyi says, right? The key word there is really community. And building access to both formal and informal mental health support. And this can range, right, from one end of the spectrum to just emotional support from teachers, from caregivers, from peers, to on another spectrum, which would be specialized children-focused, creative, expressive therapies. But in between as well, there's the role of support groups for students that will play a big role, support groups for teachers that will play a big role as well. And we know that support groups, particularly during a pandemic time, right, during a crisis, support groups can actually help, whether they're teachers joining it or students joining it, can help them gain confidence in dealing with their struggles, realizing that they are not really alone. So we need to really develop this infrastructure for mental health. And it has to go beyond awareness. Awareness is, of course, important, right? It's the knowledge and awareness, the basic prerequisite. But beyond that, we have to develop infrastructure that looks at not only reactive interventions that, you know, when there's a mental health disorder, how do you treat it, which is, of course, important. But at the same time, we need to look at the preventive approach. And the preventive approach is really about giving access to resources, access to tools before the mental health stresses escalate to something bigger. And before your day-to-day stresses, you know, you mentioned earlier about, you know, what is a normal stressor and what is actually a disorder, right? Before it crosses over from one to another, that's where we need to have the early interventions.
Okay, thank you both very much for joining us today. That was Dr. Aman Rashid, Director of Research and Advocacy at Souls Health, and Lim Jingyi from Teach for Malaysia, sharing their experience. We're discussing children and adolescents when it comes to mental health, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. On The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.